and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for this Sunday, July 19th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. We take a look at today's first page story, Visits with Family in Person at Last. It's highlighted by a picture of Nancy and Roland Rame talking to their daughter, Janelle Rickner of Marion, as she visits them across the ends of a long banquet table, her parents seated in chairs next to the wall of a large porch, and great white pillars colonnading the front of the porch. And Rick, Janelle, they all are all masked, and they're visiting across this long table. And that, of course, highlights area nursing homes reopened for visitors for first time in months, and reported by Michaela Rahm. After months of looking through a pane of glass, a Marion couple finally sat face to face with their daughter Wednesday morning. While they still had to remain physically distanced, the ability to sit at the same table as a family member marked the first time step away from the pandemic and toward a future where the pair would could leave the senior living facility they've called home since December. Said Nancy Rame, a 79-year-old who lives with her husband Raleigh at Summit Point Senior Living Facility in Marion, "I've been waiting for that to happen." Rame said they couldn't hug or even be within 6 feet of their daughter, Janelle Rickner, also of Marion, "but it was still great to see and talk to her without a window between us." She said, "This is the hope that maybe eventually we'll get out of here." Late last month, the Iowa Department of Public Health revised its guidelines for long-term care facilities across Iowa on mitigation strategies against the novel coronavirus, relaxing their restrictions against visitors for the majority of residents. That means for the first time in months, many local senior living centers and other long-term care facilities are preparing to host families on its property once again this week, a momentous occasion that indicates for some an end to an emotionally trying separation from loved ones. Quote, "We think the approach is balanced in weighing the priority of reuniting family members with their loved ones in long-term care with raised public health concerns about this population," unquote, said Brent Willett, president and chief executive officer of the Iowa Healthcare Association, which represents the state's long-term care facilities. He goes on, "So we support it, and we think it's a very careful step-by-step approach to reintroducing these visits." The Iowa Department of Health revised its 26-page guidance on the novel coronavirus pandemic on June 30, phasing out certain mitigation strategies that were put in place to keep the virus away from long-term care facilities, locations where some of the most vulnerable populations in the state live. Long-term care facilities are allowed to host outdoor visits, open window visits, or visits using a, quote, dedicated chat box, unquote, under phase one of the state public health department's three-step approach. The announcement sent some directors of local long-term care facilities to working to put plans in place. Many Linn County-based facilities are moving forward with their plans despite the fact that the number of new coronavirus cases locally and across the state are on the rise. Said Jenna Gardner, executive director of the Gardens of Cedar Rapids, which is planning to resume some in-person visits Monday, "Right now, I think, while numbers are low, and while not seeing a vast increase in our area, it's a good time to explore how to do this safely to make sure families can visit a little more often and a little more personally." The phases identified in the state's guidance are determined by metrics an individual facility meets and not on the level of COVID-19 activity in the community where the facility is located, Linn County public health officials have pointed out. For example, a long-term care facility can move to the second phase of reopening 14 days after the last positive or suspected case was identified. But supporters of the move said the strict supervision mandated by the Iowa Department of Public Health helps ensure the safety of residents within these facilities. All visitors must be screened for symptoms before the visit, which are made by appointment only, and facilities are asked to maintain a log of all visitors for contact tracing purposes in case someone becomes ill. Still, the new policy is less strict than when the state health department first released this guidance in early March, which prohibited any visit unless deemed necessary by staff for compassionate care or end-of-life scenarios. Family members have been eager to see relatives in person, and some officials with long-term care facilities say they have noticed a change in their own residents with the distance, said Sherry Orkut, executive director of Summit Point. We've had residents say this could be the last years of their life. They want to live the best they can. Officials with Heritage Specialty Care in Cedar Rapids, the site of one of the state's worst COVID-19 outbreaks at a long-term care facility with more than 100 infections among residents and staff, did not respond to Cassette's inquiries. But officials have told residents' families they are pursuing a return to in-person visits. Roberta Moss of Cedar Rapids said she was told they did not have a timeline at this point, but was told by officials they hoped to establish outdoor visits by appointment only. Moss relayed to the Gazette early last week that she told Heritage officials she was eager to see her 85-year-old mother, Unita Schleiman, who tested positive for the virus back in April, in person. Conducting visits through a window or over a phone for the past several weeks has been difficult for the family, Moss said. She can't recall how long it's been since she's hugged her mother. Moss said, I'm not even sure how long it's been. I don't even want to try to count the days. I feel like it's the elderly that need that personal communication and hugging the most, she continued. They need to know they're loved and appreciated. A visit through a window just doesn't add up to all that. To a hug. The article is accompanied by pictures also on the patio of gardens of Cedar Rapids with various tables of crafts being arranged, people sitting at a distance at these long banquet tables. There's also a close-up picture of Henry Meyer painting a wind chime as Pam Mundorf, assistant activity director, watches July 13th at the Gardens of Cedar Rapids. And there's another picture of Aldine Emerson laughing as she realizes that she has paint on her fingers at the Gardens of Cedar Rapids during that same exercise. A second front page story, after positive virus test, sleuths get to work, reported by Allison Gowans. When people test positive for COVID-19, how are others they have been around notified, often with the help of contact tracers? Whether a person's test is conducted at a doctor's office, a hospital, or a Test Iowa site, positive results are sent to the public health department in that person's county. From there, contact tracers start their detective work, calling the person and asking questions to try to track the path of the virus through the community. Their goal is to pinpoint both where someone contracted the virus and who else may have been exposed. Susan Valletta, health director educator at Johnson County Public Health, said people are considered infectious 2 days before they first exhibit symptoms. So the tracers ask people to provide names and contact information for anyone in that period they were within 6 feet of for 15 minutes or more. If the person is asymptomatic, tracers ask for the names of everyone they were around 48 hours before they got tested. The contact tracers then call those people and tell them they have been exposed to the coronavirus and should isolate for 14 days. Members of the person's household are also supposed to isolate. If they are not sick themselves, household members are told to try to stay away from the infected person as much as possible. When the contact tracers call people who potentially have been exposed, they will not identify the person who tested positive, but will simply say they have information that people have been in contact with a positive case. Linn County Public Health Food and Aquatic Safety Branch Supervisor Dustin Hendricks said the tracers would not divulge the name of someone with a positive test to that person's employer. Usually, Valletta said, employees already have told their bosses because they need to stay home for 14 days. Valletta said, employers often can help with some of that contact tracing because they know their environment and we don't. Often the employer will say, I definitely want to talk to my employees about that so we can work together in terms of contact tracing. However, employees are not legally required to inform their bosses if they have the coronavirus, and the businesses are not legally required to inform customers or to close for cleaning if an employee tests positive. We don't have the authority to close any people down, Valletta said. It becomes a business decision and a public health decision if they're concerned enough that they want to take a cautious approach. It may not even be necessary, she added, from a public health perspective. She said it is impossible to issue a blanket recommendation for how employers should respond since each place of business is different. They don't have to if they have enough staff to keep operating and can clean the areas where the employee was and worked, she said. Recommendations sometimes are pretty unique depending on each business. She normally works on tobacco prevention and control, but these days spends most of her time on coronavirus-related tasks, primarily helping businesses navigate best practices for keeping employees and customers safe. We, since the beginning, have said, please call us. We're happy to walk you through it, she said. She said the department has hired 27 people to do contact tracing in addition to the roughly 47 regular employees, most of whom have been cross-trained and are working on coronavirus-related tasks. She said about 10 people, including herself, spend time talking to businesses. In Linn County, Hendricks said that although his normal job of restaurant and other in-person inspections were largely paused when the pandemic arrived, he's been busy developing guidance documents and talking with businesses and event organizers about COVID-19 safety. The department currently has about 10 people doing contact tracing. Though Governor Kim Reynolds has allowed businesses in Iowa to fully reopen, restaurants and bars still are supposed to maintain 6 feet of distance between each party under an emergency declaration extended through July 25th. However, Hendricks said the county department does not have the authority to enforce or monitor compliance. That's up to police. Social distancing is a requirement, but it is hard to enforce that. The only enforcement would come from law enforcement, he said. Ultimately, what we can do at this point is recommend. We don't have the authority to require things. Both he and Valletta said people wondering if a business is safe to visit should look at things such as whether employees and customers are wearing masks and if social distancing is being followed. People also should consider how long they will be inside a business and near other people, and things such as ventilation. Being outdoors is safer than being indoors. I really don't recommend spending any time indoors you don't need to with individuals who aren't part of your household. Indoor air turnover rates have a big impact on transmissibility, he said. Honestly, I don't recommend eating out at all right now except for takeout. Valletta said each individual is responsible for assessing how much risk to take. We're at a place where we can't all stay home together, and we can't go back to normal right now, she said. So, in everything folks do, they're taking on a certain amount of risk. Hendricks stressed the importance of masks. I would encourage people to look past the politics of wearing a mask. I don't want people to have a biased view on wearing a mask based on anything other than science. And science says if you wear a mask, you protect yourself and everyone around you, he said. Unfortunately, we don't have a vaccine, and it could be some time before we do. But we do know something we can do is to wear a mask. The article is also accompanied by a couple of pictures of the contact tracers, four of them wearing masks and standing in front of the Johnson County Health and Human Services building. The employees pictured are Hannah Dunlop, Nate Savage, Briani Babulao, and Rebecca Nangufi. There's another picture also of Dustin Hendricks, who was quoted in the article, also standing in front of the glass-walled structure of the Linn County Public Health Building in Cedar Rapids. And the third story on the front page, cousin of George Floyd lauds a local collaboration. It's reported by Lee Hermiston, and it's from Iowa City. Collaboration between the Iowa City chapter of the NAACP and local law enforcement leaders and efforts at police reforms born out of that work has caught the attention of George Floyd's family. Paris Stevens, 44, is a nurse in Charlotte, North Carolina. She's also a Cedar Rapids native and first cousin to Floyd, who was killed by Minneapolis police on May 25th during an arrest. Stevens said she learned about a June 19 meeting between local, state, and federal law enforcement leaders and representatives from the NAACP in University Heights. During the meeting, the law enforcement leaders agreed to adopt a countywide policy requiring all Johnson County deputies and police officers to intervene in instances of excessive force by other officers. Stevens said she and her family were so pleased by the collaboration, she asked to address the group during a July 1st Zoom meeting. Stevens said she praised the duty to intervene agreement. Stevens said in an interview with the Gazette, "Each officer is going to be held accountable if they stand by and watch their counterparts do the wrong thing. If people in the community see that, and it's happening, actually happening, they'll have more respect for those in uniform. It'll put them on a level playing field. They'll see that people in uniform will be penalized if they do the wrong thing." Stephen says she learned about the local efforts from Kevin Sanders, president of the Iowa City chapter of the NAACP. Sanders and Stevens had known each other for years, and after Floyd's death, Stevens reached out to him. Sanders has worked with law enforcement since relaunching the Iowa City NAACP chapter nearly 3 years ago, collaborating on hate crime forums and training and helping University Heights establish its anti-racial bias ordinance. After speaking with Stevens, Sanders said he wanted to do more. He said, "I felt compelled to really push for change by working with law enforcement." Sanders worked with law enforcement to convene the June 19 meeting that was also attended by Johnson County Attorney Janet Linus, representatives from the FBI, Iowa Police Chiefs Association, U.S. Attorney General's Office, and other NAACP members, including Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP State Conference of Branches. After that meeting, Sanders sent Stevens and her family notes about what had transpired. Sanders said, "The family was impressed because of, one, the ability to coordinate a meeting with all the heads of law enforcement in the county in such a short time, considering the crisis. It was also very impressive to coordinate a meeting like that in such a short time to yield those sort of results." Stevens said she was grateful for the efforts of Johnson County and hopes to see them replicated elsewhere. She delivered that message during the July 1 meeting. She said, "I wanted to thank them for moving forward and committing to change in their community. I'm hoping they'll be able to spread it to the state of Iowa." Sanders said the commitment to change didn't stop with those first two meetings. In the weeks since, she's spoken with every law enforcement leader in the county on multiple occasions about topics ranging from hiring practices to establishing citizen review boards similar to the one being created in University Heights. He praised the local leaders who are committed to change. He said, "They're leading right now. I feel like they're really setting a precedent in Johnson County for the state." Andrews agrees. Her nephew, Manuel Ellis, died in police custody in Tacoma, Washington in March, so she can empathize with what Stevens and her family are experiencing now. Washington state authorities are investigating the March 3rd death of Ellis, which the medical examiner there ruled a homicide. Like Floyd, Ellis cried out during his arrest that, "I can't breathe." The family attorney told the News Tribune in Tacoma that officers had shocked Ellis several times with a taser and wrapped their arms around his neck. Floyd was killed as a Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Other officers at the scene did not intervene despite Floyd's pleas, according to a video and witnesses. Andrew said, "When I think about the family of Floyd George reaching out and having some sense of what they have been feeling during this tragic time, it's powerful. It's a powerful testament to the work our NAACP is doing. It's a powerful nod to the direction law enforcement is trying to take. And it's an endorsement that law enforcement isn't taking lightly." University Heights Police Chief Troy Kelsey admits that in the days and weeks after Floyd's killing, it was disheartening to see the efforts that local law enforcement agencies had taken in recent years being ignored. Kelsey said he questioned if the 3 decades he spent in law enforcement were worth it until Stevens addressed the group. He said, "She made me feel better about being a police officer. She made me feel like it wasn't all for naught." Coralville Police Chief Shane Crone said Stevens' comments are an example of someone starting a conversation and making an effort toward working together. He said, "I think that's important. We also have to acknowledge we have work to do. Johnson County law enforcement is not trying to say that there are not things that need to be done. There are realities. But before we're black and white, we're people. I think that was kind of the message. We're not on sides here. We're in this together as a society, a community. We've got work to do." Detective Sergeant Brad Kunkel said he was moved by Stevens' comments and shares his colleagues' hopes of moving forward together to create meaningful change. He said, "It gives me hope that a path of healing and better relations is tangible. Obviously, it's a long road. We have work to do. It shows me to stay optimistic about where we can go." Stevens said the weeks since her cousin's death have been marked by struggles, but also triumphs. She said the conversations in Johnson County and the changes to come out of those conversations are undoubtedly a triumph. She said, "His death is not in vain. We know things are going to change. It's going to take time. I want to keep this going." The article is accompanied by pictures of those who had been quoted in the article, or at least referred to. Paris Stevens, cousin of George Floyd, Betty Andrews, Iowa, Nebraska NAACP, Chief Troy Kelsey, University of Heights Police, Chief Shane Crone of the Coralville Police, and Detective Sergeant Brad Kunkel. And now turning to the Insight page, we have a number of letters to the editor. The first is from Arlie Willems of Mount Vernon, "What Reynolds Could Have Done Instead." Regarding the incident of the governor's vehicle striking a peacefully protesting constituent last month, I have 4 questions for the governor. First, was it not a government vehicle that failed to stop for a countryman in its path in Tiananmen Square some years ago? Second, is it not illegal in Iowa to leave the scene of an accident, especially in a hit-and-run situation? Reference Iowa Code 321.263. Third, would it have been too much trouble to have yelled to your driver, "Stop," or at least to have stopped to check on the well-being of a fellow Iowan who was hit by your SUV? And fourth, would it have been too much trouble to stop and talk a few minutes with your constituent about his concerns? That was the letter from Arlie Willems of Mount Vernon. Joe Pearson of Marion, letter titled, "Ferent's Story Reflects Set of Poor Priorities." It's awfully hard to feel Kurt Ferentz's hurt at having to endure a 15% pay cut from his $5.5 million salary when so many Iowans have lost their jobs and their livelihoods altogether and can't support their families. Such a sad shame that the big-name Iowa Hawkeye coaches must suffer this way, and a shame such an article is highlighted in a front-page headline. Let's think about our priorities here. That's the letter from Joe Pearson of Marion. Our third letter is from Ann Trainer of Cedar Rapids, hoping maybe Trump will just leave. Roger Stone received a commutation, not a pardon. That means he retains the right against self-incrimination, which means he does not have to flip on Donald Trump to save his own skin. Trump protects his consigliere and hitmen. We might as well have Don Corleone running the government. In the meantime, we sicken and die, and the man who has never taken responsibility for any action in his miserable life watches while we stumble through this pandemic like abandoned children who wonder where the hell the adults are, watches while we are reduced to a third world country, despised and pitied by the world in equal measure. I've become a pagan. I will kneel to any deity who promises relief and release from the grip of this cretin. Do you think we, the people, can persuade Donald to leave before he does damage we can't repair? That was the letter from Ann Trainer of Cedar Rapids. Our fourth letter is from Jim Mottinger of Cedar Rapids. Deposits paid, so where can I take my cans? Why are bottle and can deposits still being collected from us when the stores are not taking them for return? Grocery stores never have liked the bottle law, and they're using the current health situation for an excuse not to do what they are required to do. I wonder if this is happening because some grocery store chains are among the governor's largest campaign contributors. At the very least, they should stop taking our money for deposits. But better yet, they should do what they are obligated to do and take the returns. Everything under the sun is open under this governor's discretion. This should be too. That was from Jim Mottinger. Our fifth letter is from Selden Spencer of Huxley. We need health care now more than ever. I am a physician in Ames, and I became a doctor because I wanted to help people. That's why it's so frustrating to see Senator Joni Ernst voting to allow insurance companies to discriminate against patients with pre-existing conditions. We are in the midst of a public health crisis, and those living with pre-existing conditions, one-third of all Iowans, are most vulnerable. But Ernst repeatedly has voted to take away their health care. What's more, she's remained silent on the ongoing lawsuit poised to strip away their health care, leaving millions of Iowans in limbo. Ernst should be trying to help the patients of Iowa, and especially during this coronavirus crisis. Ernst must stop voting to take away my patients' health care. That was the letter from Selden Spencer of Huxley. Our next letter is from Randy Ray of Cedar Rapids. Hinson will be against an extreme agenda. Ashley Hinson is a new leader who will take Iowa common sense to Washington, D.C. She's just what's needed to get the economy back on track after the COVID-19 crisis. She'll focus on economic development that works for the country, not an extreme agenda and $93 trillion spending scheme that will wreak havoc on America's energy sector. Iowa's families need job creation, not job destruction. In the Iowa legislature, Hinson has passed legislation to help Iowa communities. She found a way to fund food protection as a member of the House Infrastructure Committee. She got the job done as chairwoman of the Transportation Committee. Everyday Iowans are in good hands with Hinson. I'm voting for her for U.S. House. That was submitted by Randy Ray of Cedar Rapids, and our final letter is from Anna Marie McCullis of Iowa City. One simple question about virus testing. Why can professional athletes get daily COVID-19 tests and immediate results when the rest of humankind has to wait hours in line for testing and weeks for test results? What are our priorities? That was submitted by Anna Marie Marcalis of Iowa City, and those are today's letters to the editor. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Sunday, July 19th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. from Cedar Rapids, Wayne A. Anderson, passed away on April 10th after a short illness. Celebration of Life Open House will be held for him on Saturday, July 25, from 1 to 5 p.m. at Morgan Creek Pavilion, 7517 Worcester Road. From Cedar Rapids, Pearl Bristow, 100, died on July 16th, St. Luke's Ed and Joe Hempel Hospice Unit. Private burial service will take place at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, with a celebration of her life occurring at a later date. Memorials may be offered for in behalf of Pearl Bristow at, if desired, to any children's charity or Westminster Presbyterian Church, Cedar Rapids, where Pearl was a member for 62 years. Online condolences for the family at cedarmemorial.com. From Cedar Rapids, Nada L. Gertz, 86, passed away July 15th in Cedar Rapids. No services planned at this time. In lieu of flowers, memorials, and donations may be directed to Nada's family, Nada L. Gertz, and online condolences, iowacremation.com. From Cedar Rapids, Pamela Ann Immerman, died June 21st. A party is being held to celebrate her life 3 to 6 p.m. Saturday, July 25th, at Veterans Memorial, that's Colonel's Stadium. All guests are encouraged to wear masks. For Pamela Ann Immerman. And from Cedar Rapids, Florine Lois, known as Butch Kopecky, 81, died Wednesday, July 15, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Funeral Mass Tuesday at St. Patrick Catholic Church by the Reverend Ivan Nienhaus, burial St. Calvary Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family 3 to 6 p.m. on Monday at Tehan Funeral Home. Memorials may be directed on behalf of Florine Lois Butch Kopecky to the family at the Tehan Funeral Home website. From Cedar Rapids, Thomas J. Zobel, Z-O-B-L, died peacefully at home July 7th. A private family interment will be held at a later date. The Papich Kuba Funeral Service is assisting the family. Memorials may be directed on behalf of Thomas J. Zobel to St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church, the Arbor Day Foundation, or the charity of your choice. From Cedar Rapids, Ted Kubicek, 100. He died on July 14th at Cottage Grove Place, his home for the last 15 years. There will be no service being held at this time, and memorials may be sent to the National Czech and Slovak Museum or the First Presbyterian Church of Cedar Rapids for Theodore L. Kubicek. From Cedar Rapids, Roland Lee Robinson, 88, died Wednesday, July 15th. There will be a small family service Monday, July 20, with a celebration of life to follow at a safer date. The Tehan Funeral Home and Cremation Service assisting the family. Memorials may be directed to Mercy Hospice. Online condolences for Roland Lee Robinson at tehanfuneralhome.com. From Marion, Judy Jones, 82, died on Wednesday, July 15th at her home surrounded by her loving family. Memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, July 27 at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion, conducted by certified celebrant Amy Hart. Memorials in memory of Judy Jones may be directed to Hospice of Mercy at Mercy Foundation, Cedar Rapids, and condolences may be shared through MurdochFuneralHome.com. From Marion, Jackie C. Vick, 75, died on Sunday, July 12th at St. Luke's Hospital, Cedar Rapids. The family will greet friends 1 to 2 p.m. Tuesday, July 21st at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. Celebration of Life service will follow at 2 p.m. Tuesday at the funeral home conducted by certified celebrant Casey Hepker. All guests are encouraged to wear masks and practice social distancing. Interment will take place St. Patrick Church Cemetery, Monty, Iowa. You may share a memory of Jackie C. Vick at MurdochFuneralHome.com. From Clayton, North Carolina, Dr. Jack Rita, 78, died Monday, July 6th after an extended illness. A private service will be held at a future date for the immediate family. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions for Dr. Jack Rita may be made to the American Red Cross of Raleigh, North Carolina, or online at redcross.org, or the charity of your choice. Online condolences may be made to the website parishfh, that's parishfh.com. From Fairfax, Joyce E. Linz, 80, died at her home on Friday, July 17. Services 11 a.m. Thursday at Knoll Ridge Christian Church. Burial, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. There will be a visitation on Wednesday from 5 to 7 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Memorials donations may be given to the American Cancer Society. Please leave a message or tribute for Joyce E. Lynn's family at cedarmemorial.com. From Manchester, Mary L. Michaels, 78, formerly of Central City, died on Wednesday, July 15th at the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester. Visitation Thursday, July 23rd, 4 to 6 p.m. at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. You may share a memory of Mary Michaels at MurdochFuneralHome.com. From Aldi, Virginia, Leela Wingerson, 74, and formerly of Marion, died on Saturday, July 11th. The private celebration of life will be held at a future date. From Monticello, Naomi, known as Nomi Bender, 95, died Wednesday, July 15, at the Monticello Nursing and Rehabilitation Center following a period of declining health. Graveside services, 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, July 22nd at Oakwood Cemetery. Pastor Emery Gillespie will officiate at the services. The Getch Funeral Home, Monticello, has taken Naomi into their care. You can, the obituary for Naomi, known as Nomi Bender, Murdoch Funeral Home, Monticello. From Bettendorf, Charles, known as Chuck Wayne White, died on July 8th. Memorial service will be held in Lamoni at a later date. Those wishing to send remembrances may address them to Catherine Joanne White in care of the Call Home in Bettendorf, and the Call Home name is spelled K-A-H-L. Condolences, SladeFuneralHome.com for Charles Chuck Wayne White. And that concludes the list of obituaries for this Sunday. On the sports page, we have a number of softball stories during the state tournament. We have from North Liberty, reported by Jeff Linder, 10-run inning provides the energy for Lightning. Go ahead, break out all of your cheesy cliches about Lightning and striking. They all apply. Iowa City Liberty erupted for 10 runs in the bottom of the third inning and pounded 15th-ranked Cedar Rapids Prairie 12-0 in a four-inning Class 5A regional semifinal last night at Liberty High School. Leadoff hitter Briley Klosterman said, "We were on tonight. Everyone was hitting. It wasn't just a couple of kids. It truly was everybody. Locked in a scoreless stalemate throughout two innings, Liberty, now 17-8, went crazy in the third. The first nine batters reached base, seven hits and two walks. In the blink of an eye, a nail-biter had turned into a rout." Liberty coach Jeff Kelly said, "We played the way we had prepared. We knew we were going to see a lot of slow stuff away. The kids had to be patient. Then, after we started hitting that, the ball started coming over the plate, and the lightning crushed it." Prairie ends the season at 12-8 as the Lightning continue in the state tournament. From Manchester, Jeff Johnson reports, "Felton's time to shine for Hawks. In a lineup of big hitters, Kayla Fenton hasn't been the biggest until last night. The sophomore shortstop's three-run home run in the second inning got her West Delaware softball team going in what ended as a 12-2 six-inning victory over Cedar Rapids Xavier in a Class 4A regional semifinal. The second-ranked Hawks came into this game with a gaudy team batting average of .376, second in the class. Felton was almost 200 points below that, but she was clutch in a clutch moment, ending a long at-bat with a shot over the fence in left center field. She added a run-scoring single in the sixth as WD West Delaware scored five times to employ the mercy rule. West Delaware is now 20-4, and it plays Washington, Iowa with a record of 10-17 in the 4A regional final Tuesday night at Manchester. Xavier ends the season at 16-10. In high school baseball, North Lynn responds in a big way. This is reported from Troy Mills by J.K. Pilcher. Well, that escalated quickly. Number 2 North Lynn unloaded on Jessup with a 12-run fourth and a 14-4 victory in five innings in a Class 2A District 5 final last night at North Lynn High School. The Lynx, now at 17-2, advanced to the sub-state final against New Hampton at Waverly. And we have a local auto racing story from Cedar Rapids by Justin Webster. Lem Cool and Friends Racing for Fun. The great Muhammad Ali said that if you haven't learned the meaning of friendship, and you really haven't learned anything. Cedar Rapids native and Jefferson 2007 grad Lenny Lem Cool has a younger brother, Eric, but his five best friends are like brothers as well. Team Toe Money consists of Lem Cool, Griffin McGrath, Michael Weber, Rusty Shaden, and Casey Corsmo, with fellow friend and racer Landon Castle traveling the country in the NASCAR Xfinity Series, while the other five compete weekly in the Legends division at Hawkeye Downs. Lem Cool, 31, not only grew up with the Olsen family, who are local racing regulars, he was assigned a seat next to Castle freshman year in science class at Jefferson. A friendship developed so tight that he had a bed at their house and a stocking at Christmas. Castle was the best man at Danny and his bride Jamie's wedding last year, while Roger Castle was ordained just so he could officiate the service. "I cannot say it enough," Lem Cool said. "I could not do this without Roger and Castle Motors. He's like a second father to me, and without him and Griffin, this wouldn't be possible." Griffin McGrath also has a local family involved with cars and racing and houses the team's cars each week, something that most racers have to worry about. Lem Cool joked of the Toe Money team name that references that amount collected for a last place finish. We just set the expectations low. We're just doing this for fun after work, Lancool said. It's so much fun to be even remotely close to all these great drivers. It's a dream come true. Historically a spotter for Griffin's late model team, Lemkuhl is enjoying owning his own car this season, which is a first for him. Lemkuhl said, "My car is the older style motor, which has a 1250 Yamaha. It's a late 1980s motor, which is air-cooled, while the newer motors are water-cooled and fuel-injected. That's a pretty big deal, but really just means that my car is cold-blooded in the morning." The team likes the Legends class because you can work on it in a normal garage, according to Lemkuhl, who added, "You can work on a big car in a garage, but it's a lot harder." The design of his car has always featured red, even when he raced for other teams, but his current paint job was designed by an iRacing friend. "I sent the design to the sticker guy and he hit print," Lemkuhl said. "We just made it a real car." As for the number 20, that was chosen by his wife and is inspired by their first date on February 20, 2009, and their wedding date of April 20, 2019. The young couple doesn't have any kids, although Lemkuhl calls himself a cat dad and admits neither a dog nor a baby would be the worst addition to the family. "My wife desperately wants a dog," Lemkuhl said. "I think we are preparing for a future child. Just don't ask her about the dog because she wants one really bad now." Who knows how long Team Tow Money can keep competing at Hawkeye Downs, but it seems like it won't be long before Lemkuhl's classmates become uncles, or at least dog uncles. Lemkuhl said both would be okay. The article is accompanied by a picture of Cedar Rapids native Danny Lemkuhl taking the front left tire off his Legends Division race car Friday at Hawkeye Downs during a post-race inspection. Lemkuhl and his friends store their cars together, as was mentioned in the article, and the automobile looks like a smaller version of some kind of an earlier model roadster, and has the word Lemkuhl across the front windshield. Back to the Iowa Today page. Public libraries inch toward restarting. Reported by Gage Miskimen. Public libraries closed to the public since mid-March are taking steps to reopen by appointment only. The Marion Public Library will reopen Monday for appointments only, with social distancing limits on how many people can come in at one time and other pandemic restrictions in place. The Cedar Rapids Public Library will begin making appointments for computer use only July 27 at its downtown and west side Ladd Library. Each patron will be allowed 1 hour of computer use a day. The libraries in both cities and the Hiawatha Public Library will continue curbside pickup of books placed on reserve. All materials are quarantined for 72 hours before being recirculated. Each library is establishing new protocols aimed at stemming any spread of the coronavirus. Plexiglass barriers have been installed around computers and checkout areas. Marion Library Director Holly Trenary said, "Library services are a critical lifeline for our community. It's critically important for us to open and connect people to resources. The hardest decision for any public library to make is to close its doors." To book an appointment in Marion, patrons will either need to call in advance or book a time online. They will be able to browse the stacks or use a computer or whatever else they might need for up to an hour. Only 12 people will be allowed into the library per hour, Deputy Director Kelly Dibvig said. The building will be open for 4 hours, closed for a cleaning hour, and then reopen for four again. The library will have a staff member at the door to check people in. Visitors will enter by one door and leave by another. Curbside pickup will be available throughout the day, including during the cleaning hour. Masks or face coverings also will be required for all patrons and staff. Patrons will be encouraged to use the self-checkout. Library staff members also will get their temperature checked before each shift and every 4 hours during a shift. The City of Cedar Rapids announced last week that city buildings will remain closed to the public through September 8, but the built library is opening for appointments July 27 for computer use. As in Marion, masks or face coverings will be required for visitors and staff. Staff members will have their temperatures checked before each shift and will be disinfecting high-touch surfaces each hour, Library Director Dara Schmidt said. Schmidt said the library will look at opening to the public with limits on how many are in the building in September. With current COVID-19 numbers, that is a wise decision right now, Schmidt said, adding access to computers is the biggest community need the library sees. We are making this slightly different decision than the rest of the city buildings because of that one resource we have that isn't available anywhere else, she said. Computer use and the connection to all online resources are essential. The one gap that's not filled anywhere else in the community is an actual computer to come use and get stuff on. Hiawatha Public Library Director Janelle Weeks agreed internet access is the driving force behind libraries figuring out how to operate during a pandemic. Weeks said even if and when the pandemic goes away, providing internet is an issue that remains. She said it's the most vital thing for us to offer. The Hiawatha Library, which has been offering curbside pickup since May, has no solid date to reopen its doors, given construction of an addition there. The addition expands library space from 8,500 square feet to 22,000 square feet. Once we get into the new building, we will continue curbside service and will go forward with making decisions at that point, Weeks said. Weeks plans to start moving into the new section July 29 and be done August 4. She said visits by appointment probably is the next step. It will be our decision as the library, but we will use the guidance of the city, Weeks said. We have all these weird interim decisions to make based on the services we will provide. It's all up in the air. The new library will be large, so there will be better social distancing. All three metro libraries have had to make staff adjustments during the pandemic, but no one has been furloughed or laid off. In Marion, Trenary said some staff went on paid administrative leave. In Cedar Rapids, Schmidt said nobody has been furloughed given that staff has been doing virtual programming and helping around 400 people a day with curbside pickup of library materials. Staffers with technology set up in their homes have been able to keep phone systems up and running. Schmidt said, our staff are working really hard and running around. I'm very proud of that. We have been able to maintain the same hours and have examined some of our positions, but everything is uncertain and we may not be able to maintain that forever going this way. In Hiawatha, staffers were put on paid administrative leave or work from home, Weeks said. When we brought people back, we did it kind of gradually, Weeks said. And when we started curbside, we realized we needed all hands on deck. It's a different busy, but it's still busy. The libraries have seen changes in circulation with fewer physical items checked out, but with more people using digital services. In Hiawatha, the June 2019 monthly report saw 24,052 items checked out. This year, it was 15,277. June is usually our busiest month with the summer program, Weeks said. This place is usually crawling with people during that time, and it's our digital materials driving this year's numbers. At the end of the day, Schmidt said each library is on the same page but making different decisions due to each building space. She said, like literally everybody else, we are trying to balance our community needs with the situation of the moment in our communities. We appreciate our patrons. They've been very supportive and patient. Divig and said Marion, too, appreciated the patience and support from community members. I hope the community knows that we've put hours of thought into our plan and checked the details to make this as safe as we can for the public and our staff. The article is accompanied by several pictures of those who have been quoted in the article and also examples of the plexiglass partitions that have been erected in spaces within the library. And there's a picture of a pair of hands handing out, looks like, three books through a window to someone who has reserved those books for curbside pickup. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for this Sunday, July 19th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.